Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I rise on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants in this case who challenge the validity of Senate Bill 586 and 571, a law which imposes rigorous restrictions upon constitutionally protected expression that is of a sexually oriented nature. Indeed, when this law went into effect on August 28th of last year, it has already proven devastating to the adult entertainment industry in Missouri, resulting in large-scale job losses, enormous loss of revenues, taxes, indeed the outright closure of several outlets for this expression that were previously thriving businesses, and the threat that others will soon close, resulting in a massive reduction in the quantity and availability of constitutionally protected expression. Article 3, Section 35 of the Missouri Constitution provides in unambiguous terms that the Joint Committee on Legislative Research shall meet when necessary to perform the duties advisory to the General Assembly assigned to it by law. Section 23.140 is such a law that assigns duties to that committee.
It says advisory to the General Assembly. Doesn't that make it non-essential? Isn't that contrary to your argument that it's a mandatory rather than a directory provision, that the statute creates a mandatory rather than a directory provision to have a fiscal note hearing?
I think not, Your Honor, because even though it's advisory to the General Assembly, it is part of the Constitution, and the Constitution uses the word shall, and it's an important function that there...
And does the Constitution have an effect, say, what should happen should a statute later be developed that has certain procedural requirements and one or more of those not be completely followed?
No, it does not. Much like the single subject rule that was decided in Hammerschmidt had no consequence for spelled out in the Constitution for failing to abide by the single subject rule, and yet this court struck down a statute that didn't comply with the single subject rule. Similarly, in Tier case, where the provision in law said that in a criminal case, if you're going to rely upon a prior conviction, that had to be spelled out before the case was submitted to the jury, but again, no consequence was spelled out in the statute as to what would happen if there was a failure, and yet this court, interpreting the intent and context and the importance of the duty, determined that nonetheless that was mandatory rather than directory.
Do you agree, your opponent points out that the Constitution doesn't require a hearing. It just establishes the committee group and says that it should meet. But the hearing is not required by the Constitution, and isn't that significant?
Well, except that I think it actually is if we take into account that the constitutional provision says they shall meet when necessary to perform the duties assigned by law. So if there's a duty assigned by law, the Constitution then says...
So the Constitution gives us authority to establish rules. Does that mean any violation of a rule automatically requires a case be retried?
No.
Because we certainly don't follow that.
No, I wouldn't go that far at all, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that in this particular case, that one sentence in that particular constitutional provision, which is mandatory and says they shall meet when necessary to carry out a duty assigned by law, when you couple that with the fact that there is a valid statute that assigns a duty to them to hold a hearing, it seems to me that kicks in the constitutional provision that mandates that they meet to carry out that duty by holding that hearing. And we think that when you consider the importance of the hearing that the Constitution under those circumstances would mandate, we think that it's mandatory rather than directory.
If we look at the requirement, if this court were to look at the requirement as statutory rather than constitutional, would you have a backup argument on that? Is there still
yes.
a reason? Okay.
Yes, we think that when there's a duly enacted statute which specifically says that a bill before being acted upon has to be accompanied by a fiscal note and that a legislator can appeal that and that a hearing is mandatorily required as soon as possible, the failure to comply with that, given the importance of equipping the legislature with the economic data, particularly in this current economic climate, necessary to make an informed decision as to whether or not a bill ought or ought not to be passed, is such an important function and required by statute that the legislature, just like every other citizen in the state of Missouri, is bound by the law. and cannot ignore a statutory requirement any more than any other citizen can. If they want to repeal it, they can repeal it, but it seems to me that they can't ignore it, Your
Honor. So what's the sanction? What's the penalty for not allegedly following the statute?
In this case, Your Honor, we think that the consequence is that the bill that was adopted is invalid for failing to comply with the constitutional requirement and for failure to comply with the statutory requirement. Turning to the First Amendment issues in this case, the plaintiff submitted voluminous, detailed evidence in support of its specific, detailed allegations in support of their claim that the scheme is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. We presented evidence that supported allegations in the complaint from a broad variety of witnesses to the effect that adult businesses in Missouri do not cause the adverse secondary effects that the legislature said it was trying to ameliorate. We have testimony from sheriff's deputies, liquor agents, law enforcement, detailing their long experience that belies the claim that these businesses cause adverse secondary
Counsel,
effects.
Counsel, the legislature had before it a lot of evidence, such as you described and Professor Lentz's work, also had a lot of contrary evidence. They made a determination. What is the basis on which you think we should relook at that evidence, and what is the standard we apply?
Well, Your Honor, under intermediate scrutiny, and I'll get to strict scrutiny momentarily if I have time, but under intermediate scrutiny, under the Supreme Court's decisions in Almeida Books, a plaintiff in our situation has a right to challenge the state's rationale in one of two ways, by either undermining the rationale and showing that the evidence upon which the legislature relied is shoddy, or by introducing evidence that disputes the factual findings by the legislature. And that is something that we have a right to do in court. And Justice O'Connor's plurality
opinion. So you're saying under Alameda Books, it's your contention that you can never have judgment on the pleadings despite many circuit court cases granting those, or even summary judgment, that you have to have a trial in every case?
You at least have to get to the summary judgment stage, Your Honor. Here we have the whole process cut off at the pleadings. We filed a complaint that had specific detailed allegations in support of these factual claims. We ultimately produced pretty voluminous evidence that demonstrates that we could support those claims.
But the claim I would like you to get to more specifically is the issue is not whether you presented contrary evidence, because of course you have and you did before the legislature, but the issue is whether you have done the two specific things required by Alameda Books, because the government just has to have a reasonable belief that there's a rational relationship between its regulation and the secondary effects it seeks to regulate. And you have to show either that the evidence it relies on does not in fact support that rationale, or you have to show that either the studies and anecdotal events don't support what they did, or that in fact they are invalid for other reasons. You can't simply do it by showing, well, they could have come to a different result, and we think rationally they should have come to a different result. That is not sufficient, because that would be stepping on the legislative prerogative. And it can be a tricky line to know where you are, if you're on one side of that line or the other. But why here did you refute each of the reasons that they gave in the legislation for concern about secondary effects, as opposed to simply showing good reasons why you think an alternative should have been that they came to the wrong conclusion?
Because we had substantial, convincing evidence that the local businesses in the state of Missouri don't cause the adverse secondary effects that the legislature claimed. And we had a 70-page affidavit detailing with 19 exhibits why their evidence was shoddy and why we were able to dispute it. Now, for example, the 10th Circuit in Abilene Retail, a case that was decided a few years ago, perfectly followed that template. And on very similar facts, we had local evidence that the adult bookstore wasn't causing adverse secondary effects, and we had Dr. Lins's testimony that undermined the rationale for the statute. And the 10th Circuit held that that was sufficient to defeat summary judgment and require a trial. The 7th Circuit in Annex Books 1 came to the same conclusion when we were challenging an Indianapolis ordinance that imposed hours of operation. And again, They were in agreement with us that the studies upon which the city relied didn't necessarily match up with the hours of operation provision that they were seeking to enforce.
But Alameda Books and Renton do not require specific evidence. They don't require the state or the city to show their regulation is effective. They're allowed to experiment and try regulations. They don't have to show, I know Dr. Lentz likes a comparative analysis, but no U.S. Supreme Court cases required that approach to be followed or required a city or state to show that, in fact, the ordinance has the effect as opposed to that they reasonably believe it may and so they want to enact it to see if it will.
But there is case law that says that in the face of local evidence to the contrary, plus expert testimony, that summary judgment in favor of the governmental entity is erroneously granted and that there must be a trial so that the court can make an independent determination of the constitutional facts and law that apply when you're talking about regulations of constitutionally protected speech. And here, of course, we also, one last thing I want to say before my time expires is that we also have a content-based argument here, because the legislature in the statute said they don't even care if the same adverse secondary effects apply in retail bookstores that don't sell the disfavored content or in nightclubs that don't offer the disfavored entertainment. And we think that argument has been strengthened by the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants, decided in June of this year, which struck down a California statute prohibiting violent video games being disseminated to minors. And the court said it was wildly under-inclusive because it didn't regulate cartoons, movies, and other forms of media that were equally violent. And the court said under-inclusiveness casts sufficient doubt on the real legislative purpose as to require strict scrutiny to be applied and as to require, in that case, the statute to be struck down. Here we have the same thing. The legislature says that even if retail bookstores, all retail bookstores and all nightclubs cause adverse secondary effects, the only ones we're going to regulate are the ones that have the disfavored content, the erotic content, and the ones that have the favored content, non-erotic speech, will be left unregulated. We think that that renders the statute unconstitutional, and we also think that this recent decision by the Supreme Court helps us. Annex Books, for example, Your Honor, specifically said there has to be a comparative approach, and you can't just single out businesses based on the content if they don't cause adverse secondary effects any different or greater than are caused by
Barnes & Noble or something? Or?
Yes, Barnes & Noble or other, in the case of nightclubs, bars and nightclubs that feature entertainment that isn't erotic. The Seventh Circuit said you got to compare that.
Mr. Murray, is up.
Thank you.
You have time to reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Murray,
yes,
are you familiar with the ABCD decision versus Detroit?
I did see it yesterday, Your Honor, and I think
it's... Would you agree that that would be dispositive if we were to elect to follow the reasoning of that decision?
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. They made no effort to show that local evidence disputed the claim that the local businesses caused adverse secondary effects. We have plenty of evidence that says that the Missouri businesses don't. They made no submission of the voluminous evidence we did. They never argued content-based, and they never argued Justice Kennedy's proportionality requirement, which is separate and apart from the adverse secondary effects issue, and which requires that the state show that it will reduce secondary effects while leaving constitutionally protected speech substantially intact. We have produced substantial evidence in our case that the constitutionally protected speech that previously was available to the citizens of Missouri has been decimated.
But there are a lot of cases that say that the mere fact that regulation has an economic effect on business does not mean it restricts free speech and does not mean it violates the First Amendment. Fantasyland, for instance, said the fact that you opened up the video booths and had a light and made sure they were visible to other areas of the business and the fact that business declined thereafter did not result from a restriction of the free speech because you could still see the videos and read the books. It simply resulted from a restriction of the the non-protected activity that used to occur in those closed areas, and that there's no guarantee that it's not going to have an economic effect. It's simply a guarantee that if you simply cannot enact regulations with the purpose of putting protected activity out of business.
Yes, but we're not making an economic argument in that sense, Your Honor. What we're saying is that...
Well, it sounds like it is, and that's certainly the way you started your argument, talking about that your businesses have been affected. But it has to be that they were affected because of restrictions on the First Amendment activity, not on restrictions of other kinds of activity which the state is permitted to regulate.
Yes, but they are restricted because of their on the basis of their First Amendment activity. They have to close at midnight. They can't exercise their constitutional right after midnight. They can't have any alcohol in their clubs. They have to abide by open booth and open manager station requirements.
And there's a constitutional right to close booths and to drink alcohol?
What I'm saying is that under Justice Kennedy's proportionality test, when you take the regulations and you determine what effect those regulations have on constitutionally protected speech, you have to come to the conclusion that they reduce secondary effects while leaving the speech substantially intact. He gave the example of if you have...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I will try to be brief in addressing the fiscal note issue, as brief as I can be anyway. As far as the Missouri Constitution is concerned, the Joint Committee on Legislative Research could have no duties and never meet. The Constitution simply doesn't care. It says it shall do whatever the legislature tells it to do, that's advisory from the president, and it'll meet when necessary, and the Constitution doesn't even decide when it's necessary.
So the fact that there was no hearing on this fiscal note, what remedy is there for someone who wants to complain about it?
Well, there is a remedy. A legislator may lodge an objection to the procedure which is utilized in passing a bill. By law, that objection then goes to the governor along with the bill, noting that there is an objection by one or more legislators as to the procedure that was followed in the bill, and the governor, if concerned enough about it, can veto that. This committee is advisory only. It can't be a substantive committee because it's only advisory. It can't serve as a gatekeeper for legislation. It can't have the power to block or hold up legislation. So we're only now looking at the statute. Appellant really exaggerates the importance and significance of fiscal notes. There is no requirement and no mechanism provided by which the Joint Committee can do scientific or empirical studies. They send out requests for information to state agencies. Sometimes they send requests and that's provided for by statute. Sometimes they send requests to other entities and local political governments. That's not even in the statute, but sometimes they do that. Many don't respond.
The shall is a shall to the legislative committee. It's not a shall to the legislature. The legislature could ignore it. It's a
I believe so. I mean,
on the legislative committee. I mean, on the research, and it's not on the legislature or not passing legislation.
The law leaves it up to the legislature whether it wants to accept any advice from the legislative committee with regard to a physical note or ignore it completely. The only requirement in the statute is that when a bill is first introduced, there has to be an original fiscal note before it can proceed. And that's in the first few sentences of 23.140. Afterwards, the legislature puts no consequence or no hindrance or burden upon itself even with regard to other fiscal notes. In fact, the hearing that they talk about doesn't even have to be before the full committee. The statute says it can be before a subcommittee. That's up to the chairman of the committee. And if they want a rehearing, then it's up to the chairman whether he even grants a rehearing. This doesn't sound like the type of...
Is this a constitutional requirement that they have that they shall provide the advice to the legislature?
It says provide such advice as is required by the legislature. And in fact, if you look at Chapter 23 on the Legislative Committee, the when it defines the statutory duties or the constitutional duties about the third or fourth section in, it doesn't even list fiscal notes. That comes later, is a section just dealing with that. In any event, we feel there's no constitutional deficiency here for sure, and no statutory deficiency that would justify overturning this law. Not to see the rest of my time as a vertical.
May it please the Court, Scott Birkfeld on behalf of the Attorney General. The crux of this case is the legal standard that's to be applied to legislative bodies when they're considering regulations to address the negative secondary effects of sexually oriented businesses. The uniform case law from the Supreme Court of the United States is that that standard is that the legislature may rely upon any evidence that is, quote, reasonably believed to be relevant, end quote, to the secondary effects they address. The contours of what that standard includes are established by the case law. In other words, the Supreme Court's decisions that set forth the types of evidence that fall within the reasonably believed to be relevant standard. What this standard includes is prior judicial decisions, crime reports, anecdotal testimony, land use studies, and expert reports on both sides. The Renton case, the Barnes case that followed it, the Erie case that came after that, none of those involved extrinsic evidence in a legislative record. All they relied upon in Renton was the state Supreme Court's decision in North End Cinema. In Barnes, there was no legislative record whatsoever. And in Erie, they relied upon Barnes and the City of Renton case. The Supreme Court said that was sufficient. In Alameda Books, the Supreme Court of the United States affirmed that exact same standard that included reliance upon judicial decisions discussing the secondary effects and spoke with favor on behalf of Renton, Barnes, and Erie. That standard is not contradicted in the Supreme Court. What is not required under that standard? Specifically, the Supreme Court in Alameda Books held that empirical proof is not required. Scientific comparative analysis is not required. In this case, the General Assembly relied on all the different types of legislative evidence that a government can rely upon in adopting these types of regulations. And then they did something unique in Missouri constitutional jurisprudence, is they made specific findings. They laid out their findings regarding secondary effects based upon the evidence that was tendered to them during the committee hearings and during the legislative process. That's all included as part of the judgment on the pleadings because it was attached to the answer.
Did the industry testify or at the hearings as far as their concerns?
Yes, they did. In fact, Dr. Linz testified to the legislature. This is a supplemental legal file, volume 1, pages 126 and following. He submitted written materials. He testified the legislature had an expert report that Jackson County, Missouri, relied upon in the case where Chief Judge Guy Tan upheld the Jackson County legislation, which is materially identical to the statute at issue here. So there was competing evidence on both sides. But even if you consider that evidence, the challenger in these cases have to challenge the legislative rationale for addressing secondary effects. And they have to address all of the evidence upon which the legislative body relied. That rationale is that the regulations will decrease secondary effects without substantially decreasing speech. And Your Honor hit it right on the head, referencing the Fantasyland video case. The open booth restriction, which has been upheld by every single federal court of appeals to ever address it, says that the videos continue showing there's no regulation of content, there's no regulation of what sex scenes people can watch, but those videos can continue just as much as before without the privacy and the enclosed spaces which create opportunities for illicit sexual behavior.
Can you address Alameda Books' burden-shifting test and when it applies and how it's consistent with granting judgment on the pleadings? Opposing counsel says it's not, that it really requires them to have an opportunity to present contrary evidence.
Well, Your Honor, two things. First of all, what is the burden-shifting standard? Before and after the introduction of that burden-shifting language in Alameda Books, the Supreme Court reiterated the any evidence reasonably believed to be relevant test. They specifically cited Renton, and then they said there's two ways that a challenger can challenge this. Number one, they can offer an argument that the legislative body's evidence doesn't support the legislative rationale. That's the first way. The second way that they can do it is they can offer their own evidence that disproves the legislative body's factual findings.
And is that in court? They can offer that evidence?
Well, they can do it before the legislature like they did in this case. The presage to that was the Candyland case where the Justice O'Connor's plurality opinion said nobody offered this and told this to the legislative body before they adopted this statute. But the important thing here is this. They never challenged the rationale of the legislature. For example, nothing in Dr. Lenz's materials says or even alleges that the six-foot rule is not a reasonably designed regulation to decrease the illicit sexual behavior that's documented in this record between strip club patrons and erotic dancers. Nothing argues that. That's just a logical consequence of the regulation. Similarly, nothing in his materials even alleges that opening booths will not decrease the illicit sexual behavior that was documented in the record to be occurring in the Jefferson County, Missouri peep show booths. There's no argument on that. He argues a separate rationale. He says that the government has to have empirical comparative analysis. In other words, he basically says that the legislative body cannot rely on the exact types of evidence that the Supreme Court has said are included within the any evidence reasonably believed to be relevant standard. Thus, for example, he never attacks any of the judicial decisions. There's no explanation whatsoever, and not even an attempt in his materials to explain why the General Assembly could not rely upon the 3 8th Circuit cases that have repeatedly upheld open booth regulations based on the documented illicit sexual behavior going on in those booths. Why? Because he can't. He can't. There's no intimation, Your Honor, in Alameda Books that every regulation can be successfully challenged. There's no intimation in Alameda Books, for example, that a six-foot rule that very logically decreases the opportunity for prostitution and drug crimes in a buffer between patrons and erotic dancers has to be successfully challenged.
Did he challenge the hours requirement and the nudity requirement? Those are also...
Well, he did, but all of his challenges boil down to the same thing. What is the standard? He basically challenged the hours requirement and the nudity requirement on the theory that it's not supported by empirical scientific proof. And the Supreme Court of the United States has said that you don't have to have those standards. So really,
is that what the legislature was getting to when they had that sentence in the legislation that said we don't need to compare this to other types of bookstores or other types of establishments?
Exactly, Your Honor. It has nothing to do with the content-based argument that Mr. Murray's trying to make at this juncture. Couple of things. Just first of all, he can't cite you a case that holds that these are content-based because of this legislative finding. In fact, that identical legislative finding was at issue in the Peekaboo case that was affirmed by the 11th Circuit, judgment as a matter of law, in the Supreme Court denied certiorari in June. This morning, 1 hour ago, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit issued its opinion in 84 Video versus Sartini. It's directly on point with our case here. It's a statewide hours of operation and no touching statute. And in that case, the plaintiffs, represented by Mr. Murray and his able firm, came in and challenged the constitutionality of the regulation. There was a 4-day trial, a preliminary injunction hearing, at the conclusion of which Dr. Lenz testified. Basically, it was what went before the legislature all over again.
But that's what they wanted, the hearing.
Yeah. And
judgment of pleadings assumes all the facts in favor of them, but still they don't have a claim.
Your Honor.
They just want a hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, but to the extent that the Supreme Court of the United States has said that you rely on judicial opinions and other materials that have never been challenged, let me finish saying what happened in 84 Video. After there's a full hearing, the court denied the preliminary injunction and then took summary judgment motions and granted the motion for summary judgment and said, notwithstanding we had this whole big hearing that was spread across 2 months and 4 separate days in federal court in Cleveland,
But they didn't have a summary judgment either. They did not have a summary judgment.
You're saying it said all this evidence doesn't actually create a factual issue of any kind because, as a matter of law, it's up to the legislature to make their legislation.
Exactly, and that's what the Sixth Circuit said this morning. They affirmed the summary judgment.
Right. But isn't it true when you're looking at the standard of review on summary judgment that the federal court standard of review is different than our state court standard of review regarding summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor,
and so to that extent, maybe those cases aren't persuasive. No, I'm not talking about the First Amendment or so forth, but when we're looking at the standard of review, the federal court standard of review is different than the state court standard of review.
Actually, Your Honor, I think they are persuasive, and let me say why.
Even as to the standard of review, how is that binding on this court?
Well, first of all, Chief Judge Guy Tenn in the federal court in the Western District of Missouri granted motion for judgment on the pleadings,
right,
and it was a JOP. The federal court of appeals in the Sixth Circuit in the Sensations case, which was followed by the ABCDE operating case a couple of weeks ago, granted judgment on on the pleadings. But here's what's different about when you're challenging a legislative judgment in this context. The legislature here, the General Assembly, heard about, for example, the Daytona Grand case. And the Daytona Grand case was a six-day trial in federal court in which the court said judgment on the as a matter of law is inappropriate. I'm going to hold a trial. And so Dr. Lenz testified. He came in, and Dr. Lenz testified, and the district court struck down the statute. On appeal, the 11th Circuit reversed in toto and upheld all of the city of Daytona Beach's ordinances because they were constitutional as a matter of law, and the judge applied the wrong standard. He applied Dr. Lenz's empirical proof standard, and the 11th Circuit reversed. So where a governmental body can rely upon what happened in another case that went to trial, that only the more supports judgment on the pleadings, because it shows that even if you go further in the procedural process and all the evidence is presented like it was in 84 video and in Daytona Grand, judgment as a matter of law.
So is what you're saying is, what is the question before us? Say we say there had been a hearing below, or we were to send it back down for a hearing, and all the evidence that opposing counsel is talking about came in. He presented evidence of a lack of effects, that they'd done a study in the neighborhood and found a lack of effects, and that they had other evidence that hours don't have anything to do with crime, and banning of alcohol doesn't reduce crime. Are you still saying that the state should be entitled to judgment?
Your Honor, yes, only because within your question there's a premise that I would challenge, and that is treat the summary 56 summary judgment affidavits, which the district court did not, trial court did not address, the circuit court, because he granted the judgment on the pleadings and deemed the summary judgment moot. But treat them as sort of a proffer at what they would put on at trial. Mm-hmm. There's still no answer to the legal decisions upon which relied in the findings in the court cases, and that alone, if you read the 84 video case, Judge or Dr. Lenz's failure to address all those various categories of evidence mm-hmm. is enough of proof of the secondary effects.
Because the Eighth Circuit has held you have to undercut every rationale.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You may answer her question.
Go ahead and answer Judge Fisher's question.
Okay. Well, so as I understand your argument, maybe then, is that it doesn't the judgment on the pleadings or a summary judgment, either one of them, doesn't require us to weigh the evidence, because to the extent that evidence has to be waived, if at all, it's already been done by somebody else.
That's true. And, Your Honor, under the any evidence reasonably believed to be relevant standard, all of their challenges to the evidence simply presuppose a different standard. It's like Your Honor was addressing early on in my opponent's argument, that we have evidence of illicit sexual behavior in the clubs. There's nothing in even Dr. Lenz's expert study that says the six-foot rule or the open booth rule won't reduce those secondary effects. And his failure to challenge why it was unreasonable for the General Assembly to rely on the Eighth Circuit cases dealing with these specific types of regulation. In other words, it comes down to their position is there's no law on this. It doesn't matter if this court upholds this statute. If another county in Missouri adopts this next year, we have to go through the whole thing again. At some level, governments and legislative bodies have to be able to use law as the predictive tool. What the General Assembly did in this case is they relied upon this on-point evidence and on-point cases, including judicial decisions that have never been challenged, to uphold the exact same regulations that have already been upheld by the courts.
If your opponent challenged every aspect of the legislation, would they still have a case or not?
Well, Your Honor,
your point is they didn't challenge every aspect of the legislation.
But no, because the way that the proffer of evidence at summary judgment shows that they're going to challenge it is they say if it's not empirical, it's not valid. Let me give you one example, and I think it's on point. Look at the Tucson indictment by Dr. Lenz at the legal file, volume 5, page 758. This is a document from the police department in Tucson documenting in spades illicit sexual behavior inside adult bookstores and adult cabarets. Dr. Lenz's response is, this is not empirical. He moves on to the next thing in the legislative record. That's because there's no response for it. There's no response to an argument that every appellate court has upheld the six-foot rule, every appellate court has upheld the open booth rule, and therefore I'm going to ignore all that evidence, which under Renton and Barnes and Erie is legislative evidence that you can rely upon, because there's no answer to it other than it's not empirical. But that begs the question of whether empirical evidence is required. The Supreme Court has emphatically said it's not.
And by empirical evidence, you mean a comparison of the number of sex crimes before and after the requirement, that kind of thing?
That's right. And even if there is more crime at a regular bar than an adult cabaret, which is the crux of his arguments, which is the sine qua non of his position, it doesn't matter because a six-foot buffer will still reduce the secondary effects of illicit sexual behavior, even if there's other crimes or even more crimes at another place. The only constitutionally required rationale, and the one that Dr. Lenz and all of his proffer does not challenge, is that the regulation will decrease secondary effects while allowing the actual speech, not necessarily unprotected activity like drinking alcohol, to continue. And in this case, as well as in the 84 video case, and the Ohio statute that was upheld this morning by the Sixth Circuit, the actual speech continues and it goes unaffected while the reduction in secondary effects occurs during the overnight hours, during the physical touching between patrons and dancers and between closed booths that harbor illicit sexual behavior. The General Assembly carefully told the line, and under the any evidence reasonably believed to be relevant standard, the judgment on the pleading should be affirmed, because while we accept their well-pleaded allegations, we do not accept legal conclusions or conclusory allegations of fact, and that's all that they have here. And it's proven by what their proffer is. They don't have an answer to the cases we have relied on, and the General Assembly can rely upon the cases and the findings therein. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, all of his arguments would go to the question of summary judgment, would go to the question of what should happen after a trial on the merits. We have judgment on the pleadings. We have well-pleaded allegations that say that these businesses locally in Missouri do not cause adverse secondary effects.
I think his point is that the legislature also had contrary anecdotal evidence and contrary specific studies, and it's not like, as it normally would be in a case, then for the trial court or for the trier of fact to balance those and decide who's right. If there is support for the legislative finding, we defer to it. We don't substitute our judgment. We don't decide which one's stronger. They can rely on a small amount of evidence, much smaller than the contrary, if that's what they find persuasive.
Not according to the Supreme Court's decision in Almeida Books, which says that the municipality's evidence must fairly support their rationale,
right,
and that if plaintiffs succeed in casting doubt on a municipality's rationale, either by demonstrating that the evidence doesn't support it or by furnishing evidence that disputes it, then the plaintiffs have succeeded in shifting the burden back. And
doesn't that legal standard, though, in that case, assume this proposition that each individual legislator is entitled to believe or disbelieve all part or none of the evidence of any witness?
Not when you get to court, Your Honor.
Well, you say that, but as judges then, do we to call in each individual representative and say, now what part of this witness's testimony did you believe or disbelieve, or did you not believe anything they said? I mean, how is that legal standard practical or even allow for any consistency without the proposition that each individual legislator is entitled to believe all part or none of the testimony or evidence of any witness on either side of the case?
Because when you get to court, we're not questioning the legislative motives or intent. What we're questioning is whether or not all of that evidence upon which they claim to rely, whether we can demonstrate through our pleadings and ultimately through evidence that that evidence is shoddy and that, for example, in Missouri, they're wrong. So, that as a matter of fact, we can disprove the contention that these businesses, in fact, cause adverse secondary effects.
So your legal argument is basically that you would allow each individual panel of every circuit federal court or each member of every state Supreme Court to reweigh the evidence on every piece of legislation that every legislature passes without giving them any deference as to what they believed or didn't believe that was presented to them, either live or in writing or pictures or whatever.
No, I'm not suggesting that no deference is required. What I'm suggesting is there's a constitutional test here under the First Amendment that applies to a regulation that singles out speech based on its content and tries to justify that content-based distinction on the theory that that speech produces adverse secondary effects. The Supreme Court says that we have a right to come into court and put on evidence that challenges that underlying theory. And we certainly have a right to get beyond judgment on the pleadings. What we have here
is
a complaint.
And do you have specific evidence showing that there's no adverse effect, opposing counsel said, of the 6-foot buffer of nudity, which in Erie the Supreme Court said you can ban nudity. It's perfectly proper under O'Brien and under Erie. Four, maybe six courts of appeals have approved limitations on hours and similar kinds of limitations. All those are wrong.
Well, you've got Annex Books that says that that's wrong. You've got Abilene Retail out of the Tenth Circuit that says that's wrong. Yes, they reversed summary judgments. Annex Books went on to the Seventh Circuit grant affirmed a preliminary injunction against an hours of operation.
So and the is it your position that the legislature cannot rely on prior judicial decisions alone?
I'm sorry, did you say alone, Your Honor?
Uh-huh. Your opponent argues that you refute some of the other evidence, but you don't refute the prior judicial decisions, and those alone are enough to support the legislature's action.
No, I think that what we have refuted them because the judicial opinions that they rely upon the underlying data that we have rebutted. So, for example, in the Erie case, the Pabst case that upheld the anti-nudity, Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion, and she presaged her opinion in Almeda Books. Here's what she said. Here, the plaintiff, Candyland, has had ample opportunity to contest the city council's findings about secondary effects before the council itself, throughout the state proceedings, and before this court. Yet to this day, Candyland has never challenged the city council's findings or cast any specific doubt on the validity of those findings. And then 2 years later, she wrote Almeda Books and outlined the ways that a plaintiff can make that showing by either undermining the rationale offered by the state or by furnishing evidence that disputes it. And then a court must decide, either at the summary judgment stage, if that's the appropriate point, or after a trial, as to whether or not the plaintiff has met its burden, and if it has, as to whether or not the state, when the burden shifted back to them, supplemented the record with additional evidence to support their theory. But you can't do it at judgment on the pleadings because we alleged all of the underlying facts necessary to contest it. We file a complaint, they file an answer and attach all of their evidence, and then they say it's over, that we never get beyond the complaint and the answer.
Are there any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.